Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Kentucky and a Grassroots.
This is your host, Matt Singleton. And what I am doing is I'm making a small series of apologetics arguments. And basically, apologetics was basically a word coming from the word apologia, which meant to give a defense. And basically, the early Christians practiced apologetics in the government. Apologetics was a way of giving a defense of the faith in light of government persecution. Now, at this time, there are a lot of arguments that we see left versus right, and the right typically assumes not to argue religion because they want freedom of religion. The left does argue religion. The left does impose religion. In fact, not only is the left imposing secular humanism in the public schools as it has been for decades, it's not even inculcating the religion of Islam into the curriculum. And so now we have all these policies to get people to doubt the faith, because once we doubt the faith, then we can doubt some of the other worldview presuppositions that founded our culture. And once we can get rid of the culture, then the government can turn its back on its citizens. And that's the whole point. So basically, I've done a couple already. I've dealt with evolution, I think was the last one I did, to show that the theory has no basis anymore. It's been long dead. It is extinct. Also, the rationale for believing in God, not believing in God, but why it should be presupposed first as opposed to last. And then also we did a show on Jesus Christ and the proof of his existence and resurrection, deity, etc. So today we will be focusing on the authority of the scripture. Where does the authority come from? Well, the authority, of course, comes from God, being that the Word of God is inspired by God. Inspired means breathed. It could be like when you're speaking, you breathe out every word. So how do we know that that the Bible is inspired? Well, some of that we know because the books that we have are interwoven and knitted together. But also, they have to stand on their own as far as, like, this idea of supernatural. And the idea of the supernatural has to be undergirded. And so the foundation for the supernatural with the Bible is Bible prophecy. You see, Bible prophecy shows that there is a supernatural element to the scriptures. And so, if these prophecies get fulfilled, well, then we know that there's something that's not natural, that's supernatural, and therefore we understand that this is divinely inspired. The founding of our country was not to debunk this fact. It was simply to allow people to take it as it is freely. That was the whole idea, religious liberty, not religious secularity, or maybe making world. But anyhow, let me go over some Bible prophecy. Now, one thing that you have to remember is that there are different types of Bible prophecies. And so how do we know that the scripture is authoritative? A lot of these Bible prophecies are what we call short-term prophecies, that there were prophecies of something that's going to happen soon. But we don't really have, you know, being far away from the event, we don't really have a knowledge of whether or not these were accurately done or they were done later. And so the school of classic liberalism tries to push the dates of the books further ahead into the future or our past, making them closer to us, so that these could be things that were dishonest and that these were just things they made up. But then there are prophecies that would surpass the dates. And these would be what we call long-term prophecies. Long-term prophecies are passages of prophecy, foretold events or things happening hundreds, if not thousands, of years in the future. Now, there are close to, you know, somewhere in the hundreds to probably a few thousand Bible prophecies out today, and that's where it kind of gets a little rough, especially, you know, if somebody's not a Bible scholar. How do you know these different things? How do you pick which ones are the best to use? Because some of these prophecies are knitted together to where they don't sound like they're much until you put them all and build them all with the other ones. And then you see how intricately woven they are. So the first long-term prophecy I'll go ahead and look at is in Genesis chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, we see Abram, who would later be called Abraham. And he says this, Genesis chapter 12. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse them that curseth thee. And in thee all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So now we have a prophecy. Some of it is short term. For instance, that Abram has to leave his land, which was what we call the land of the Chaldeans. I think there's a couple different titles because William changed his name a couple times. I believe he was in Ur. But we also know it was the land of the Chaldeans. And basically, he was to get out of that country. And he says, I will make thee a great nation. And so how do you know that, you know, if you're going to start at that point, and that was probably around 2000 B.C., how do you know that they're going to become a great nation? It's just one guy. Then not only that, he's like an old guy, okay? Even if he has a seed, how's that going to become a great nation? Now, it says, I will bless them. What is it? Okay. And I will bless thee and make thy name great. Even today, some of the Jews are some of the most successful and the richest people on the earth. And it says, so it says, and will make thy name great. And, of course, everybody all over the world talks about Jews. You know why? Because not only do you have the religion of Judaism, which not the biggest religion, but it's been a long-standing one. And it says, but also you have Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And then, of course, several counterparts. You know, maybe Mormonism, maybe Baha'i, all these different counterparts that would base themselves off of Abraham and honor him. And this is, and thou shalt be a blessing, and I will bless them that bless thee. America has been a blessing to the Jewish people and rescued them from World War II. They've also had Jews active all through its history. And cursed him that curseth thee. And look, Germany cursed the Jews, formed the Holocaust. And what happened? Their empire got destroyed. They were one of the most powerful nations on the earth at the time. No longer. And Abram departed as the Lord spoke to him. Okay, so that's the first prophecy. We have the existence of the Jewish people. And the existence of the Jewish people is going to last for another 4,000 years. How can you predict that? And then on top of it, you had the Holocaust. Okay, there was attempts to destroy the Jewish people from off the face of Europe. And later there would be other ones, too, that are now in our history. From Assyria to Babylon to Persia, there were many attempts to wipe out the Jewish people. we move forward just a little bit, we find another Bible prophecy. It's very interesting. And this one concerns a competitor who is also a son of Abraham. And his name was Ishmael. Let me see if I can find him real quick. Okay, here is Genesis chapter 16. See, Hagar, she was the slave of Sarah, Abraham's wife. And Sarah had trouble conceiving. And so the suggestion was made, well, maybe you can conceive through Hagar, and since I own Hagar as a slave, therefore that shall be mine. And yet that was not God's promise. So it says in 16:8 of Genesis, and he said, Hagar, Sarah's handmaid, whence camest thou? Whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarah. So she got kind of jealous after a while. The angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress and submit thyself unto her maids. The angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. So this is going to be like, you're going to have thousands, you know, way more than thousands of things. The angel of the Lord said to her, behold, thou art with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And she called the name of the Lord and spake unto her, thou God seest me. For she said, have I also here looketh after him and seeth me. So what's going on? Well, Ishmael is going to be the head of a nation. Now, if you read in the Quran, it makes a big deal about the fact that the Arabs are the descendants of Ishmael, okay? So the Arabic nations all descend from Ishmael, and it says that he'd be a wild man. So in other words, the Arabs would have a tendency to violence. Well, that's true. And they have been battling against others, and others have been battling against them as a result. So you see that in world history. You see the Arabs being part of a lot of war offensively and defensively. And it says, every man is handy of him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. So they're going to sit around, and they're going to be in the presence of the brethren. Guess what? The Arabs are neighbors with the Jews. And, of course, they are multiplied far exceeding that of the Jews. Now, it's one thing to prophesy victory, but now you've got somebody prophesying an enemy. Think about this. How could Abraham, you know, or Moses, who's, you know, collating this manuscript together, how could they have predicted? By the way, Moses would have been in Egypt, or, you know, it's like, how would he have had anything to do with that? Okay. But how are we going to know these guys are going to remain that way? And they'd remain that way thousands of years later, okay, eons later, it's still going about. How find somebody to be against you thousands of years from now? How do you get that right? Okay. I mean, they prophesy about the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites. Well, you don't know those people? Oh, well, they all dwelled around that time, too, but did anybody notice them? Huh? No. The Minoans, you know. The, you know, I'm starting to forget the names. But that's the problem, is that you have all these forgotten ancient civilizations, okay, and these survived. And they were prophesied. And what's another one? Well, then you have another one that's a long-term prophecy. And it is in the book of Daniel. And Daniel, it goes through a series of world civilizations. So let's see if I can find that.
Daniel chapter 2. All right, so King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Now, the key is this dream is that he later on goes through several other visions of the events he described them more thoroughly than the one I'm bringing up here, okay? But there is a dream, and Daniel is the one to interpret it, okay? The king has a dream. He's the only one who can interpret the king's dream. So he does that. I'll start at Daniel 2:36. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, that means he's an emperor, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given under thine hand, and if they be ruler over them all, thou art this head of gold. So in his dream, there is a statue, and there is a head of gold. The head of gold is Babylon. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces, and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest feet and toes, part of the potter's clay, and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of iron, of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. Then the toes of the feet were part of iron, and part of day. So the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. So now we have this statue. Okay, what does it represent? The second one represents Persia. You have Babylon, and then Persia. And then we'll describe that in the later chapters of Daniel and go through the different things. And so then, it talks about the next empire, which is Greece, because it covers all the earth. And guess what Greece did? Through Alexander the Great, they covered all the earth. And then the statue turns into legs, and legs of iron. It splits off, obviously, because of two long legs of iron. Now, what is interesting about that? Well, basically, the Roman Empire took over probably around 100 to 200 B.C. Forgive me, I'm not focused on dates right now. But around 150 to 200 B.C., the Roman Empire will take over. And when the Roman Empire takes over, it will split into two, an east and a west. But guess when it splits into the east and the west? Oh, around 400 or 500. And not even like fully, okay? That's really like when Constantine shifts over from Rome, Italy, to Constantinople. And that's what starts the rift, that starts that shift of the Eastern and the Western. And then they're going to split off permanently by 1000 AD. But then, you know, we have this thing that's iron, right? So the one substance is iron, it's hard, it's strong, it's long. What is that? That's a long history. And then it breaks off and merges in with clay. Now, that, you know, the clay is an illustration in a lot of Bible prophecy about what God does when he makes a people. So, what does he do with the people? He makes them from the earth, from the clay. And so that could be God's people mixed in with the empire. All right, so those are some basic long-term prophecy. Well, I'll hit one more. Let me go back here, and I'm going to turn the page. Hold on a second. All right. I'm going to be reading from Isaiah 11:11. And it shall come to pass on that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, and from Egypt, and from Pathos, and from Cush, and from Elam, and from Shinar, and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign, which means a flag, for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And so basically, Israel would be restored, brought back. That the nation of Israel would be brought back as a people. And so what happened in 1948? The nation of Israel was brought back as a people. Now, I don't believe that this prophecy is complete in its fulfillment yet, because they will at some point accept the Lord Jesus Christ, probably during the Great Tribulation. Yet, we have another sign of long-term Bible prophecy. And the problem is with the textual criticism that was designed by those who do not believe in the supernatural and was argued that these documents are later, is that they would then make complex theories on how these documents were constructed, and that they're all different pieces of different tribes worked out over the centuries and blurred and blended together. And they do this in the Old Testament. They also do it in the New Testament a little bit. In the Gospels, for instance, they have something called the Q source, which was supposedly another witness to the Gospels. Between the writings of Mark, Now, the writings of Luke and Matthew that were separated, that were distinct, that were not in Mark, so Mark wasn't giving to Matthew or Luke, and yet they were separate, and so this was called the Q source. But all these theories were just rationalizations. In other words, they had the idea, they had the hypothesis, but they never had the evidence. They never found manuscripts of one of these sources isolated by itself. And that's part of the theory, is that, oh, this came from these different ingredients. Well, then you have to find that ingredient, which here the ingredient is this other source. So you have like the JEDP theory. You have to find the Jehovah source, the Elohist source, Deuteronomist. Well, they never found those scriptures isolated that way. They were never torn apart. They were always together. So you have no evidence of that. And on top of it, now you have Bible prophecy supernaturally talking about things that are past those dates anyhow. So now we have to admit that the Bible is a supernatural book. So if it's a supernatural book with long-term prophecies, then we don't need those theories. But then there's also short-term prophecies. And the short-term prophecies are what kept the books going in the first place. Because, you see, the Old Testament has the opposite problem that we do. They wouldn't know if those prophecies will be fulfilled thousands of years later. So how do they know to accept this stuff? Well, they know to accept this stuff because of Bible prophecies that would be fulfilled in their time and history. So we look, and what were some of these short-term prophecies? The great flood of Noah. Noah gave a warning, the people didn't listen, and God flooded the earth. Now, how do we know that God flooded the earth? Well, number one, non-Christian sources of the ancient days tell of a great flood. Hundreds of stories, of legends, of different tribal peoples tell a version of Noah and the ark. And they tell of a version of the great flood. Okay? And basically, when you see all the different tribes and all the different nations that do this, you find somewhere between 250 to 600 different folk legends from people all over the earth. you have these legends in South America, Australia, China, Africa, Europe, Russia, America, all over the earth. But then also you say, well, what if that's just a great fiction? Aha. You find evidence of catastrophe in the earth. Now, there was a fellow who took over geology back in the 1800s. His name was Charles Lyell. And he developed a system and classified all the rocks into a column. They called the geologic column. And different people have different listings, but there's usually about 10 to 15 layers which are also which are classified by them as time periods or eras. And these 10 to 15 layers are supposed to be the natural history of the earth. Well, they have his column, as he proposed it originally back in the early 1800s, the column was supposed to be ultimately about 100 miles deep, and that would have accounted for 1 million years of history. But now we claim that the earth is covering 3.3 billion. Now, the physical earth goes 4.6 billion, but I'm talking about the development of life, okay? These are also called, the geologic column is also called the fossil layer because these columns are based on that, and I'll tell you that in just a second. But, yeah, so basically they grade these columns, and they figure, okay, there's about 10 to 15 of them, and that'll be for billions of years. And yet we've never dug 100 miles deep, okay? In fact, the deepest that we've ever gone is about 12 to 15 miles. So basically, you know, what was 100 miles covering 1 million years is now, and usually it's more like a mile, okay? But at the deepest, 15 miles, but usually a mile, covering, you know, 3 billion years of history. So it's way off. But then there's more. Out of all these columns, only 15% of the Earth has three of those layers in the correct order in those bases. So at a maximum, if we have the most conservative estimate, if we take that for 15 layers and we just get a little bit more bland, we go down, let's say 10. We're just talking about those 10, only three. That's 30% of 15% is accurate to what we see in the earth. Okay? So this is just a massive, okay, a massively unobserved idea. And, you know, when you deal with that, then you got to take this and look at it another way, though, okay? Because these are the fossil layers, right? Well, if they're the fossil layers, then how are the fossils made? Well, some are made by volcanoes, but the vast majority of fossils are used by water-related catastrophes. In fact, there are water fossils all over the earth. You know, people will see things like shark's teeth all the time. But even in, Mount Everest, okay, the legendary tallest mountain, even though I know that the other one next to it is supposed to be taller now and all that kind of stuff, but even in Mount Everest, they have found aquatic fossils. Okay, they've also found giant pearl shells in the Andes Mountains. So even in our highest mountains, there is evidence of water and water damage. And then when we look at what's called the Precambrian layer, which has what they would call the Precambrian explosion, because they've got this on a certain time scale, and so they figure that all these animals died at this time. But if we change that around and take the chronology out of it, and by the way, the chronology is based on circular reasoning. The fossils are dated according to the rocks, and the rocks are dated according to the fossils. So if we take the chronology out of that, what do you have? You have a layer all over the earth called the Precambrian layer that's stuffed full of fossils, which were made by what? Water, sedimentation, catastrophes. Flood. So you have this flood of animal fossils all over the earth, and of course plant fossils too. And you have these fossils are not divided up. You will often find dinosaurs and mammals, their fossils will be buried together. I saw one with a mammal with a baby dinosaur in its belly. There's a lot of these all over the place. So that leads us to conclude that the flood happened. Then you have Moses in Egypt. Now, how do we know that Moses was in Egypt? Now, obviously, you'd have to go with the bird's eye view of the people back then. Why didn't Egypt call them out and say, "You Jews are liars. You Jews were never here." Okay, and they'll say, "Well, their history doesn't talk about it." Well, people don't like to talk about their defeats and their history. Okay, but also, you don't have a big protest movement. Why don't you have a big protest? Let's look at this. Number one, Moses. Is Moses a Hebrew name? You think, of course. Hold on. What about King Tut? What about King Tut? Well, his full name is King Tutmos. And I think there's a couple other Moses, Amos, and all that kind of stuff. Well, basically, Moses is the Egyptian word for the water. Maybe it's drawn out from the water, but Moses water. So he has an Egyptian name. Makes sense if he is the son of the Egyptian king. Archaeologists have uncovered Jewish settlements in the land of Goshen. And they have found a miniature pyramid tomb, which the archaeologists claim is Joseph. They also found one of these giant wall plaques in that area, and it identifies Joseph, you know, the Prince of Egypt. Well, no, I don't know if he was a prince. He was a high leader at the time, though. And basically, you have this working idea, okay? If the Jews were there, how did they get out? And why did the Egyptians not make a huge deal about this written law that was everywhere, okay? Everybody knew this legend. Even the Jewish scholar Philo, who interacted, he lived in Egypt. And he'd say, everybody in the world knew what happened with Moses. They just didn't like to talk about it. Well, Philo is a Jew living in Egypt telling the Egyptians that. Okay? Then you have the prophet Elijah. Elijah had a high amount of respect and he performed a high amount of miracles. And one thing that's weird about his story is the fact that it uncovers Israel in a state of apostasy. You see, King Ahab had become a Baal worshiper because his wife was a Baal worshiper, and she was not a Jew. So the king had broken the law, and was now making Israel apostate. And Elijah stood up in defiance of that, and in defiance of him. So why would you honor a prophet for basically standing up against an apostasy which the people really don't want to brag about? They want to brag about a guy who exposed them? Because that's basically what he did. He was the whistleblower. How do whistleblowers get treated? C. Edward Snowden. People don't like whistleblowers, okay? But this is what gave that prophetic authority, okay? This is the people at that time seeing it happen and why they are preserving the traditions of books that would make prophecies that would last for thousands of years, even though they had no idea that those prophecies would last thousands of years. Then you have the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, by the way, I missed a couple Bible prophecies with the New Testament. The New Testament says that the church, in Matthew 16, the gates of hell would not prevail against it. What's that mean? It means it wouldn't die. Christian church did not die. We have Christians today all over the world. It says that the scriptures would be published all over the world. Guess where they're published? All over the world, in every culture. Now, there may be individual languages and individual ethnic groups of people, but every nation has been touched by the Christian message and has been provided with a translation of the scriptures. So, more long-term prophecies. Now, there's one that is very incendiary that Christians 500 years ago were unanimous about. It has a lot of proof, but unfortunately, it is definitely politically incorrect for Christians to mention this fact. I guess I'll have to go ahead and do it. All right, here we go. Oh, let's see here. Revelation 17. You have to forgive me. I'm doing a couple things here. All right. Let's see if I can find. I'm getting close. All right. Revelation 17. This is the Mother of Harlots, Mystery Babylon. It says, and there came one of the seven angels, which had seven vials, talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. Waters are peoples in the prophetic dream language. Okay, whenever they have dreams, waters are typically people. Why would that be? Well, if you ever go to a giant rock concert, you will find the large groups of people moving about in waves. And then you see a lot of people in these giant stadiums making waves. And so they appear as waters. And it says there's a whore. What is a whore? Well, a whore is one who is doing something that they are betrothed not to do. Okay, like an adulteress. But they are doing it, making money off it. They are benefiting from this sinful relationship. And so it says, sits upon many waters, whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. So the whore has a relationship with the many nations and the many kingdoms. And it is having a relation, which should be something that she should only be doing with the one she's covenanted with, the one she's married to. But apparently she's broken off that relationship and is now in a relationship with many nations. Okay. And the inhabitants of the earth have made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And so they have drunk with this woman, and she has become part of them. I believe this is fulfilled by the Roman Catholic Church, because the Roman Catholic Church has formed these relationships with the nations of the earth. And also, there is a relationship that embodies paganism. And so the gods and the kingdoms are all merged together in the ancient paganism. Okay, you have the family of the gods, you have the family of the royalty. Okay, and so she is in a relationship with them, and she is drunk with them. Well, how would that work out? Well, you have the mass. Okay, they are having that relationship. They are drinking with all these groups of people, and they're also committing idolatry. And they would take idol statues, okay? Like, let's say we're worshiping the god Jupiter, and they would remove the idol of the statue from Jupiter, and they turn it into Peter. Or there would be a statue to Hera, and they would remove the title Hera, and then put in Mary. Okay, and so they replace the gods with the saints. And it says, so it carried me away in the spirit and in the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of the names of blasphemies. So scarlet, that's a Roman color, having seven heads and ten horns, and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet. If you look if you go to the Vatican, you will find the cardinals and bishops arrayed in both purple and scarlet. And precious stones, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. She would ride upon the beast. The beast is the one world nation. And it says that upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And so she would have influence over all the other religions. And you find the Catholic Church doing this through what we call the Jesuit order. And this is a song of a woman drunken with the blood of saints and with the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered in great admiration. This is a very super powerful institution. But she's also killed many Christians. Guess what? The Roman Catholic Church has persecuted many Christians. You can see this through the Inquisition as well as the Crusades, because they would go out and they would also war with Eastern Orthodox sometimes during the Crusades. But anyhow, let's see here where to go. And it says, the beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall send out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they shall dwell on the earth and shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And so this world government kind of formulates and then falls apart and formulates again. New world order. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Now, I've looked this up in Funk and Wagnall's Encyclopedia as well as the Encyclopedia Britannica. And Rome is known as the city that sits on seven hills or seven mountains. So basically, that is Bible prophecy there, okay? So you have, like, the church is going to last, the whore is going to last, the Bible is going to last. That's the long-term prophecy. Short-term, Jesus prophesied the destruction of the temple. He did that in Matthew chapter 24. Now, he deals with the end times in Matthew chapter 24, but he's asked about both. And I usually divide it up as the first half of Matthew 24, 1 through 15, I believe, deals with the destruction of the temple and what Christians would go through in their persecution at that time. And then the gospel of the kingdom will go out throughout all the earth, and that is the Great Commission, and that will last until the end, the abomination desolations prophesied by Daniel. So at that point, it's going to skip ahead to the end times. Okay? So I'll divide that up. But basically, all those prophecies go back to the big whammo of Bible prophecy. The big whammo is our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Now, let me go ahead and I'll see if I can zip through some of these. I don't think I can zip through. But we will touch on some of these real quick. When I say real quick, I got to look it up first. All right, let's see here. You've got John the Baptist. He's prophesied and says, "Comfort ye, comfort my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, crying to her that her welfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. For she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God." And so John the Baptist was there, and he was a historical figure doing this stuff. Let me check here earlier. Alright. So, there is a Son of God. Some Jews would argue against this. Good. It's not their book, it's God's book. In a way, it's their book, but it is more God's book. He inspired it. Without him, there is no book. Okay? So, when they get it wrong and God gets it right, you know it's the book of God. And he says, "I will declare the decree. The Lord has said unto me, Thou art my Son, this they have begotten thee. Ask me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession." And so the uttermost parts of the earth are Christians. Okay? That was prophesied about the Son of God in Psalms, written 1,000 years before Christ. And then when it comes to his birth, you know, we know it's a virgin birth. Genesis starts us off. "I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed." What seed? Seed is semen. Women don't make semen. How can a woman have semen? Well, basically, that's talking about the virgin birth. Isaiah 7:14, "Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." That means God with us. And so, well, what if virgin is just young woman? Well, most young women are virgins. There's similarity there. But that wouldn't be a sign to have a teen's pregnancy. Behold, there's a teen pregnant. Well, there's lots of teens pregnant. Okay. And then she shall call his name Emmanuel. Okay. What does that mean? God with us. With Jesus, he's God with us. Micah chapter 5. "But thou, Bethlehem, Ephratah, though thou be little among thousands of Judah, yet out of thee he shall come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose going forth have been from old, from everlasting." There it is again. He's going to be born in Bethlehem. The Messiah will be born in Bethlehem, and he is the Son of God, and he is virgin born. And it says, now this is just kind of interesting side prophecy. These are these things that have these little illustrations that interwove together. And if you look at the whole tapestry, it all makes sense. But if you see One Piece, it's not quite as compelling, but still. When Isaiah was a child and I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. So you'd say, okay, that's just Israel. But Israel failed, remember? Okay. Matthew 2, when he arose, he took the young child, 2:14. He took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt and was there until death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord, by the prophet, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son. Okay. All right, so let's see here. And then in Isaiah 53, we have the big passage. But I want to hit a couple things. Well, first, here's the thing. The Messiah is going to be betrayed. Well, Jews don't believe that, right? Okay, but Zechariah says in 11:12, okay, one of the books of the Tanakh, and I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price. If not, so they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. And Matthew 26:15, and said unto him, will ye give me? I will deliver him unto you, and they covenant with him for 30 pieces of silver. Psalm 69:21, they gave me also gall for my meat, and in my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. Now, also, Zechariah, let's see here, chapter 12, make sure we get that one. Zechariah 12 is very powerful when it comes to the Bible prophecy. Let's hit that real quick. Okay, the burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens, layeth foundation, the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all people round about when they shall be in the siege, both against Jerusalem, or both against Judah and against Jerusalem. That was something that's been fulfilled. In fact, it was fulfilled in America at the Democratic National Primary in 2012 when there was a big ruckus on the other side of the world over whether or not Jerusalem was Israel's capital. But then we go forward over here and there's this prophecy. I will pour out upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of grace and the supplications. We're waiting for that one to happen. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. Well, they can't pierce God the Father. Whom they pierced? The Son. And they shall mourn it for him as one mourneth for his only son. And they shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. There you have the piercing of the firstborn son. Now, let me go back to Daniel. But we're going to go to Daniel 9 this time. In verse, let's see here, 26. And after 62 weeks shall the Messiah be cut off. The Messiah shall be cut off. Remember this, Jews? Oh, you didn't want to talk about that? The Messiah shall be cut off. Not for himself, the people of the prince, that shall come and shall destroy the city, the sanctuary, and the end thereof, shall be with a flood. And the end of the war of the desolation was determined. So now we have a prophecy. Again, that the Messiah, who is the Son of God, shall be cut off. That means he shall be killed. And he talks about him being pierced, right? We go over here to Psalm chapter 22, I think. right. Now, you really got to build that foundation before they really fully understand this, but if you're really into the Gospels, it just kind of comes out anyway. It becomes very obvious. But in this kind of area, we need to kind of understand this is David's psalm. But David, it's going to be his seed. It goes on for the everlasting kingdom. And that seed is, of course, in Jesus Christ. But let's see here. And they gape upon me with their mouths as a ravening and a roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue clingeth to my jaws. And thou hast brought me into the dust of death, for dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and feet. So I tell all my bones, and they have a stare on me. Of course, it starts off the thing. It says, my God, why has thou forsaken me? And that's what Jesus said when he was on the cross. My God, why has thou forsaken me? And all the imagery becomes very strong. And they say, well, when it says they pierced my hands and feet, a literal reading of the Hebrew would be, they were like a lion in my hands and feet. But what do lions have? They have nails. And lions are massive animals. And when lions strike you with their nails, we're talking about 3 or 4 inches, okay? So what does that do? That goes through your wrist, any normal wrist. That's going to cut right through, like nails. Nail scar hands. They're piercing my hands and my feet. Okay. Now, I know that there's a lot of other Bible prophecies, but let's go ahead and we'll go to the big one. That's Isaiah 53. For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Jewish interpretation, oh, that was the king of Persia. He was not bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, and we have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, and he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter. Jesus didn't fire back anything. He tried to defend himself when he was on trial. And as a sheep before the shears is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. And I believe that Jesus, as opposed to the tradition of Good Friday, I believe that it was actually during Passover, because Passovers are also considered Sabbath. It says he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as sheep before the shears is dumb. So he opened not his mouth, and he was taken from prison and from judgment. And who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. It says he's cut off again. That merges that prophecy with Daniel, the Messiah. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. And he made his grave with the wicked. Remember, he's with the two thieves. He's crucified. Okay, he's with the wicked. And with the rich in his death. That was Joseph of Arimathea. How could Isaiah have prophesied that Jesus would be buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea? Because he had done no violence. Neither was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. And when thou shall make his soul an offering for sin. He shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days. And the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many. As the Apostle Paul teaches that we put on his righteousness and that he justifies us by God's grace through faith in the Messiah, faith in his blood. For he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercessors for the transgressions. And so here you go. The gospel foretold, almost explained. I don't blame these Jews for not understanding, you know, with a great depth of what was going on at the time. But now that it's fulfilled, it should be obvious. You know, there was going to be a prophet equal to Moses to come after Moses. And so if the prophet came and he was supposed to be on the level of Moses, that would be the Messiah. But it also means that there would be further, because you got to prophesy about some things. Okay? So that means that there's going to be an extra period of time. And that relates to the Christian era. But going back, you got to think about this thing as far as the proof of probability. Now, there was a mathematician named Peter Stoner, and he said this. Now, what are the odds that only 48 of the more than 700 that we know of prophecies of Jesus were fulfilled? Dr. Peter Stoner estimated the odds against just 48 of the 300 or so Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah being fulfilled in one person. He calculated the odds at 1 in 10 to the power of 157. That was Science Speaks by Peter W. Stoner, copyright 1958, 63-68, Revival State, page 333. And then the mathematician, Emil Borel, he wrote, "This illustrates why it is absolutely impossible for anyone to have fulfilled the Messianic prophecies solely by chance." Emil Borel is a leading authority on the probability theory, and he states in his book, "The Probabilities in Life, once we go past 1 chance in 10 to the 50th power, the probabilities are so small, it's impossible to think they will ever occur." So the chances of fulfilling all these prophecies are impossible. All right, that was his book, Emil Borel, 1962, Probability in Life, Dover, translated from the original Les Probabilités et la Vie. So basically, that's what you can do. You can go look that stuff up. But at the end of the day, we know that God has put infallible proofs of his word. And it really is his word, and it really is supernatural. There really is such a thing as the supernatural. All right, we will catch you all later here on Kentuckiana Grassroots Radio. Good night.